But for the sake here, you know, right after the sort of Technicolor Stargate of like the lights coming at you.
Yes, and you get the more, the monochrome stuff.
Right. And that's where I lost during the color stuff is where I lost some time, but once that ended, I regained myself.
Right.
And I didn't lose any more time there. And what I noticed is that you will see, if you want to go with this from this good and evil battle, what I noticed is you will see a light colored burst up in the upper left-hand corner, a very kind of angelic white light. And then at the bottom, you have this deep red, yellow sort of, what I've always thought of being an embryonic fluid up
Yes,
the bottom. But I was able to see as almost this Faustian conversation between the colors there of here's a slow dark red on the bottom, and then this bright white on the top. And it keeps kind of going back and forth like that. And I realized one of the things I allowed myself to see was this as a sort of almost either battle between heaven and hell, whether that be for Dave Bowman's soul or just whatever. But this sort of conversation here between the lower part of the screen being dark red and the upper part of the screen being bright white. So that's something that you guys might want to check out if you can just watch that see that sequence with that in mind. It is actually pretty interesting, particularly from a color theory perspective.
Yes, well, if you think of the start, just to add to that, the undeveloped egg, it has a yellow yolk,
Yes,
right?
exactly,
And then
exactly.
we see the blood. That's
Which is how
the
I've always thought of it. Yeah, I've always thought of it
Yeah,
being
it
very
seems pretty
embryonic.
straightforward.
Well,
I don't know how you
exactly.
could
Yes,
not see that.
yeah.
Well, that's what I'm
No,
saying.
you're
So I've always seen that, but this was a new, again, a new, a new other way of looking at it. Since I'd always looked at it as being very like the explosion as being like a sperm and
Hey,
orgasm, and then you have an embryo, and then the
doesn't
development.
how is this not like it just seems so fucking direct at this point? Like in terms of like every fucking like all the rocket boosters for all of our Apollo missions being like designed by JPL, and Jack Parsons is reciting at every takeoff the hymn to Pan, and then you have like Pan Am in this film and the way that he's specifically trying to create this moon child, and how you have the star child emerge at the end, and how if I don't know if you guys looked at my ThinkBook chapter, but that's
I
my
finished.
whole fucking entire focus of like basically looking
Exactly.
at LSD as the moon child, and then this film is like being brought out as like the fucking like that's the whole thing is it's the ultimate trip, and what is coming out of it in terms of like this like
David,
affected
what I
people.
want you to consider right here, though, is that the McKenna quote where he says he couldn't tell if the mushroom was the alien or if it was what allowed him to communicate with the alien. So in this sense, and I'm very supportive of your idea of LSD might actually be the Moonchild, but it's also the idea of, or does it, is it the Moonchild, or is it what allows you to communicate with the Moonchild?
Right, which is the same thing as the Ark. Because people
Yes.
look at what's in the Ark as a thing in itself, and it's like, no, this is a transmitter. And so, yeah, no, I love that. And then that's what's between the two pillars. That's
Right,
the
which is
whole
what the
point.
moon, which is of course what the monolith does. It transmits a message. Why they go to Jupiter in the first place is, hey, this thing just transmitted a message to Jupiter. Why it's what the projector. If we talk about this from the J. Widener perspective of the monolith is the film, the screen. It's the idea of what are you projecting or transmitting. And as I said, so ultimately, what
Yeah.
I come to this thing of, is it. That he's so on one angle you have the idea of trying to bring something out, and then on the other side you have the sort of more Valis loop perspective. And I don't know if I'm really doing justice to your theory, Mark, but again the idea of immersive theater. So this comes full circle for me a week later, and I'll just say this quickly: is I went to see my father-in-law was in a play, a stage production of Annie, and which I had never seen, and. A very weird thing in itself, but it was funny. There's this one scene where Annie and Daddy Warbucks go on the radio trying to find her parents, And it's weird, like, they have this ventriloquist there and all this other stuff. And we talked about the scene afterwards, specifically that scene. And he said, yeah, he said, we weren't sure exactly what we were doing with that scene because she's supposed to be on the radio, but then there are sort of certain visual things. And he said, we decided to do it as if at that point, he goes, the audience probably doesn't realize, but at that scene, the audience becomes part of the play. So for the rest of the thing, the audience is watching a production of Annie. But in that one scene, the audience becomes a studio audience for this radio show.
Right, right.
And this is the idea, again, of immersive theater, is that rather than breaking the fourth wall, pulling you into it. And so when he said, you know, this idea, the audience doesn't realize it, but at this point, they've become actors in the play, or they've become part of the show. And this was exactly echoing my experience of a week or so earlier with 2001 of, is it the Stanley Kubrick trying to usher in a moonchild, or is it trying to pull you in? Or there's also a way to sort of rectify these two ideas is almost, if you want to go to the idea of like spirit possession or things like that. Did you guys ever watch the TV show Quantum Leap?
I did watch it a little bit, many decades ago, but yeah.
In Quantum Leap, I mean, I also haven't seen it in decades, but something that stands out to me, because when the main character time travels, the people, you know, he kind of goes into their body. He essentially possesses them. And in a few episodes, what they would show is that the people who he possesses end up in the future. And where they would go is to this white room. Okay, which very much looks like the end of 2001. So basically, like, they would keep – the scientists in the future would keep them in this white room so that they couldn't – they wouldn't really know what they experienced. And for however long the guy is basically possessing their body, they're in this white room until he changes whatever he needs to change, and then they go back.
That's right, yeah.
But they didn't allow them to really see what the future was like or see anything outside of this white room. So here we have the idea of – you know, if you're opening yourself up in this psycho-spiritual, psychedelic media experience of 2001, and he's trying to usher in a moon child, is it the idea of allowing something to essentially possess you while whatever is you gets trapped inside the screen?
Okay, I want to share something, and I'll do it as quickly as I can.
No, please.
I realize we're all so fucking excited because this is our favorite subject matter there is. So, okay. I've seen 2001 in the theater three times. Two of those times I was on psychedelics. One time on mushrooms, one time on LSD. Whatever, on the radio, full disclosure, fuck it. Okay, so, and I've had very profound experiences with that. But I've realized I've seen that movie probably more than just about any other film. And it's embedded in me as like, and at this point, it's like hieroglyphic. Because like the images come up and they're like tarot cards. I mean, I see them, you know? And right. So I was like, in this whole conundrum at a certain point of like about 4 years ago or 3 years ago, I don't know what it was, like basically dealing with this whole, like, I'm uncovering synchronicity between film and albums. And I'm like, and I'm going through this whole, as scientific as possible, trying to like see how the fuck is this going on. And I had recently found the Alejandro Jodorowsky Hollywood, and Holy Mountain and Marilyn Manson's Hollywood Sync. And so I'm like, I'm going to do a fucking experiment because I'm a DJ. And I'm like, I'm going to do this. I knew I have to do this birthday party, which is funny. I realized after the fact, you know, Frank Poole's birthday in 2001. Nice. But it's this, you know, it's a psychedelic birthday party, basically, at the place I lived at in the woods. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to go there. I take a heroic dose, or what I would consider for myself a truly heroic dose. And I'm like, I'm making the fucking soundtrack to 2001 tonight. Like, and I'm going to record it, and then I'm going to watch it while I'm still in this experience. And so I fucking go there. And I'm like, as I'm recording, I'm visualizing, and they're projecting and manipulating Fantasia in front of me. And so I'm just like, I am visualizing 2001 to the absolute best of my ability while I'm peaking. And so I do this soundtrack, And it's like, it's a totally crazy, magical experience in the first place that I'm internally having, because I'm going through the movie and I'm working out the timing in my head. I'm like, I do know this movie this fucking well. So like, this is what's happening right now. And so, you know, and it's an 80 minute recording. So I'm like, this should take me to shortly before the intermission. And then I'm like, Pink Floyd metal. Like, I'm all about Echoes and Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite. I don't even want to touch that. If I'm going to view this film, I'll do it this way. And so I attempt this. And as I watch it in the morning and I wait 3 seconds after the MGM lion and I start my recording and I'm all by myself and I'm kind of like hunched over watching it. And as the apes are touching the monolith, I have like a dimensional, totally profound, transcendent shift of perspective.
Yeah, I
where I'm completely like, the thing is like, it's hard to explain, but it's like there's a cube of space and the cube is just unfolded, and I'm seeing things from angles and sides that I've never seen before.
That's really cool.
Yeah, and so there was something extremely like secretive about what was taking place. Like I was being shared something. It was like and I had the same experience actually with The Shining at one point, I've seen that in the theater once before, but one time on my own I had smoked DMT through the entire film, and kept increasing the amount as I watched it, and I had an experience where Jack Nicholson, his head started to bulge out in all directions as he was in the bathroom having this conversation with
Delbert Grady.
Yes.
That's and his, yeah.
Yes, and so, and then his face actually turned into a reptile. He grew scales, turned into a reptile. I saw the screen at the end of a long, dark tunnel. So I'm in my room, and a tunnel is emerging, and I see the screen out there, and he is literally emerging from the screen, trying to get out of the screen as a reptile. Very fucking weird, but that's another thing.
Wait, if, right? Can I just? I don't want to interrupt your story, but just want to say, I also, during the 2001, my 2001 viewing, the screen became incredibly 3D, and certain things popped off the screen more than others. And there is a scene when Dave Bowman is in the white room, and he, he's sitting at the table eating dinner, and then he like gets up and walks to the doorway to see, is someone there?
Sure.
Well, I saw that the way it was and the way I'm watching is, and bear in mind, at this point I'm thinking in a very like classic Christian devil, like this is a satanic thing. I asked to see what Mark saw, and I get this very terrifying like satanic vision, and seeing Dave Bowman dressed very like dapper, like no longer like the relatable Dave Bowman, but I'm seeing him as a representation of the devil at this point. That Dave Bowman is the devil, or is Satan. And the way he steps out and looks around, he's looking at the audience, and what I see is him stepping out of the screen, this giant, like, you know, giant man, step out of the screen and basically survey the audience and look at them like, yeah, what motherfuckers, like, and then step back in.
He's looking at the audience, which is a reflection of himself.
Yes. Yeah. So if from the perspective in that paranoid moment of seeing him as Satan, it was very like almost like looking down on everyone in a superior way. But there's what you're saying is exactly also true, is him going like, it's not just that he sees the other Dave Bowman, but that he sees the audience. It's like, wait a second, am I in a fucking movie?
Right.
Yes, or am I in the audience?
Yes, yes.
Yes, not just in the movie, but am I somebody else sitting out there? So what that creates, David, you got something you wanted to throw in here?
No, go right ahead.
Oh, okay, yeah, so this... I've written about this in a couple of my articles, particularly at Metafilm. The opening sequence of the movie. Back in the day, I don't know how old you guys. You guys are both in your 30s, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, I'm getting close to 50 myself. So, and you know, I got to experience movies in a way that you probably have, but probably not as much as me. And what that was is this, that films were really dying in the 70s, basically. Like, the medium was not doing well, which is why there are so many great films in the 1970s. Because filmmakers could do whatever the hell they wanted to do, because nobody gave a shit, right? And this is why there's so many classic films that today people look at and go, wow, these films are incredible. But at the time, they weren't important. People weren't talking about them, right? The Godfather is probably the main contradiction to that idea. But anyway, you know, so I would go into these theaters, which were mostly empty and very often completely empty, which was a really interesting experience. However, I can't make that claim about 2001, Okay, so when I saw 2000, okay, I've lost my train of thought here because of that little IM. Okay, one of the things that was very common.
What is that, sound? I'm sorry, I was just wondering.
No,
etching sound.
I'm not touching anything. So
I hear it too, but I think it's just sort of like a staticky white noise. It does sound like someone writing on paper, but
okay.
I'm not touching anything, so.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm not hearing it either. Okay, anyway.
Don't worry, man.
No, it's okay. So let's just get back to the first image of 2001. I sort of lost my train of thought there because I do get very excited when I'm talking about this.
Oh, you're talking about how different it was to see it in the 70s when no one was there.
No, because I didn't see it that way. The first time I saw this, the theater was full. But this experience of the empty theater was movies. The whole experience of going to a movie was very different in the 70s than it is now. And one of the things is the big screen. Like, now you have IMAX, right? But back in the day, they had this thing, the 70-millimeter Panavision screen. And the Panavision screen was curved. It was slightly curved, like, so you'd be looking into a concavity, right? It was probably maybe, you know, a 4 or 5 degree curve, and these screens were huge. They were huge. They were actually bigger than your standard IMAX screen. And this is the screen that I saw 2001 on for the first time. I'll tell you about my experience later, but in regards to the opening scene and this idea of the character, are you in the movie? Is the movie in you? Are you in the audience or are you in the film? Are characters in the film, in the audience, is all summed up in the opening sequence. And when I mean the credit sequence, okay? What you have, basically, are three points of interest. There's the bright light shining near the center of the screen. Then there's the curvature of, you know, the crescent curvature of what could be a small planet or the moon, right? People often think it's the moon, but it's not, the middle one. I don't know what you guys, I'd be interested in hearing what you think each of those sources are, but I'll tell you.
I thought it was like the back of someone's head, like
Well, that is it, that's it. And if you'll notice, you can see the curvature of the moon. That's the big one. It's at the very bottom of the screen, and it curves just slightly, right? Mm-hmm. So what you're actually looking at is when you watch that opening sequence, you are actually looking at a member of the audience being illuminated by the light of the camera. You can see the outer shape of their head, but you can't see their face because they're completely backlit. And what it more likely is the curvature of the top of a movie chair, making it possible that the chair is actually empty. Yes. So that the chair might even be empty. So this is one of the things that the film does is it creates an immediate existential crisis. And then the bottom thing is actually the movie screen itself. So you are perched behind and above the movie screen, looking into the audience at what either could be an empty chair or the head of the viewer, essentially. So it's a knockout concept. I don't think it's ever been stated anywhere that perfectly. And this is the idea of what cinema is supposed to be, right? When you go... I mean, things are about themselves. The medium is the message, so to speak, right? But that was just the point I wanted to make. Does anybody want to throw anything else?
Yeah. I could run
with it. I'll just.
No, I like the idea of it being a giant breast too.
There's no question about that. See, Kubrick was. There's no question that he was not putting one image in. He was way too smart for that. Way, way, way too smart. The level of plies, the level of pages in every one of his images may be the proverbial 1,000-page tome, essentially. You know, you could just keep looking through one film after another. And when I mean what I mean by film is by layer, right? These, you guys are familiar with the idea of thin films, right? And the way, and it's very important too, thin films. I don't know what you guys know about math, but the Hypercube was actually designed using thin films. It was the only way they could figure out how to do it because they didn't have computers at the time, right? So they wanted to actually have a model of the Hypercube. So they created these very, very thin layers of film of different colors. And then they were stacked one on top of the other until they made a complete cube. And there were literally thousands. There were thousands of them, right? And this is kind of what I think Kubrick is doing in his movies, is that there's one layer upon another, upon another, upon another. But it creates a complete concept. And the idea of it being a breast, I assume you mean that the nipple is the tip, is the glowing yellow light, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so...
the projector, yeah.
Yeah. Not to go on about my own infamous and not that interesting work, but in my article, in Moon in the Middle, I associate the sun to a tip of a nipple, right? And if you think about the glyph for the sun, it's a circle with a dot in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, correct. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, to Aleister Crowley, I've never been able to get over the infantile belief that the universe is made for me to suck. And I would add that's because we live in the Milky Way, you know?
Absolutely. Sure, that's brilliant. I haven't heard that Crowleyism before. So, does anybody have anything they want to throw in, or I can just kind of go off a bit here?
Please, yeah, please, go ahead, go for it.
Go for it.
So I thought I'd talk about, just as a point of interest, since we started with Alan's description of his recent experience, I thought I'd tell you about the first time I saw the movie.
I would love that, yeah.
Yeah, so the first thing you need to know about is the person I was at the time, basically, which was not sophisticated. All right, I come from a working class family. The first person to graduate college in my family is actually my niece. So, you know, that sort of thing. And I definitely wasn't into art or anything like, I thought I was, but I wasn't really. I just liked to be entertained, essentially, like everybody else. And I had a real fondness for movies and TV. I mean, I was suckled on the television, without a doubt. And I would wake up late as a kid and watch movies while my parents were sleeping. There are many funny stories to be told there, but that's a long and tawdry tale. Anyway, so... I was 15 years old. I know I was in the 10th grade. Yeah, I was in the 10th grade. And so my first year of high school, and I was actually in a remedial class. And these two guys, I always thought I was above it all. You know, I felt like as a person that I could see things more clearly than other people could. And my response to this was, I just don't give a shit, basically. Like I was what you would call a very softcore punk, essentially. Like I wasn't a vandal. I didn't want to destroy society. I just basically wanted to, you know, watch a good movie or read a good book. And particularly, I like to listen to classical music. And by the time I was 15, I was pretty much an expert in classical music. It was the one thing that I knew a lot about. I was also brought up Catholic, and that's important too, because I'd read the Bible and I'd seen a lot of religious films. But they show them in Catholic schools. These Hollywood productions are actually funded by the Catholic Church. And there's dozens of brilliant, brilliant films that were essentially made under the auspices of the Roman Catholic Church.
Pope just saw 2001 in a theater and stood up and basically exclaimed afterwards that it was the highest expression of the Gnostic experience he'd ever seen represented.
That's exactly correct.
Wait, exactly, this just happened?
Correct. Yeah.
I didn't know that. That's fascinating.
What?
But,
wow.
Well, yeah.
2001 has been on the Vatican's list of movies that all Catholics should see for a long time. Basically, you can check that out on Wikipedia.
No, I believe it, because as I said, like, it was in that moment, it was very Catholic, which is interesting for Kubrick, who, you know, has had some issue with Catholicism. And then you have I don't want to interrupt your story, but just to say, like, the experience after I left the theater, as the psychedelics continued to wave on and on and on and on and stronger and stronger, was that it was a ridiculously Gnostic, very, very Gnostic experience, like the classic, and not necessarily pleasant.
Well, Gnosticism is not pleasant.
Yeah, exactly, as I'm saying. So like, not like, oh, I transcended illusion, like it was like transcending illusion, but also, well, if everything's illusion, oh my
exactly.
God, what
that's
the fuck am I doing?
Effect.
Yeah, right.
That's a natural side effect of transcending illusion is you're going, holy motherfucker.
Yeah.
For my entire existence, I haven't known a single damn thing, not one damn thing.
Right.
And I thought I knew everything. And that's how earth-shattering it is, basically, the Gnostic experience. And I didn't know the Pope, the recent Pope, I guess, interestingly enough, Francis, maybe we'll get to that later, but said that about the film. And I would, that is the exact right.
I should double check with my friend Andreas. I believe he was saying that it was the new Pope. That's what I remember, but I could double check with him.
The fact is,
but that, but a Pope did that. Well, as the star child showed up, he stood up and was like, holy fuck. So
yeah, well, there you go. I mean, to me, that proves my point that the film is strictly Gnostic, all right? However, the problem is, what is Gnosticism, right? I mean, how do you define what Gnosticism is? And as a person who, I say this, and it sounds arrogant, basically. Believe me, it's not, because I'm literally trembling in fear most of the time in my life. That's just, it's the life I live, and I love it, by the way, but it's difficult to handle, and it's not necessarily something that I would recommend. It's not necessarily something I think of it as good. For instance, the concept that ignorance is bliss would be the supposed opposite of Gnosticism, right? And so you can, you know, maybe it's not so blissful to have a Gnostic experience, a truly Gnostic, a completely Gnostic experience. But here's how I would define the complete experience of Gnosticism, and I defy anybody to disagree with me on this. Gnosticism is when... What it is, it can be summed up in two words: justified paranoia.
I like that. I like that.
That's it. It's when you feel paranoid and you realize you've got a good reason to be, that you are literally being watched. And you know, if you look at the Alex Gray images of the eyes all looking down from a canopy, you get the picture, the idea of what it is to live in a Gnostic reality is
Yeah, it's interesting, because that was the thing, was like how an Alex Gray can present it as a beautiful image, and at the same time, if you're actually, and this was, I think, one of the other things was that flavored the experience for me, was because I felt like I had gone into the film to an extent. As I said, at first, I'm watching the movie from a technical appreciation, and then once I start actually feeling what the characters are feeling, and I realized for Dave Bowman, to go through that is not like this Jake Kotzian, like, oh, yay, we've trans... It's like, it's fucking terrifying. He ends up in this fucking room, and he's, like, old and beat up and shaken, and there's, like, these, like, kind of, like, chanty voices, like, ooh, and he's like, he'd be fucking terrified.
And he was in there, presumably, for an infinity of time.
Right. Too. Right.
That's
right.
How come he takes it so calmly at the end. That's how come his actions seem... He's much more than just an old man.
Right. I guess not to trivialize. Exactly. Like, but yes, I guess my point being, like, it would actually take an eternity to calm down.
Oh, yeah. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. What it takes is an infinity, which right. means you don't. Right?
Right.
That's the whole point. You don't. So let me get back to my... I won't go off on too many digressions here. So... I was in this remedial social class with a bunch of basically misfits, and I considered myself to be a great intellectual, but I wasn't the slightest bit interested in education. And these two guys started talking about going to see a midnight movie, and this happened to be my birthday, and I was already going to a movie that night. Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, actually, was what I was going to. But 2001 was being shown at a midnight showing, all right? And I actually asked. I had a group of friends. I was in a marching band when I was a kid, and it was a bunch of the marching band people that went to the screening of Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. I tried to talk these people into coming with me to the 2001. None of them would do it, including my best friend, who was a cinema crazy, but he just wouldn't do it. He didn't want to do it. So I went and I met these two guys there. We went in, we sat down, we were watching the film, and you know, I had heard about the movie from, believe it or not, a stoner that was a friend of my parents when I grew up. And I, like, when I say I was a parochial person, I didn't do things like drugs. I didn't drink when I was a teenager. I was like Lily White. I was George Bernard Shaw, basically. You know, I didn't touch any kind of anything. I was terrified of all that stuff. And so, of course, I was as clean as a whistle when I went to this movie on my 15th birthday. So, but nobody would come. So we went to the film, watched the movie. Now, the experience of the film for me was, the first thing is I was immediately gripped by the music. I had actually only ever heard Richard Strauss's Zarathustra in that popular thing that they used to call Switched, or no, not Switched, what do they call it? Stars on 45. I don't know if you guys remember that. Stars on, you can look it up. It's like they would play popular melodies and they'd sing Stars on 45, keep on burning in between these popular melodies. And that's where I'd heard the Richard Strauss before. At that time, I was really into Beethoven, so I hadn't even touched Strauss or the idea of opera and all that other stuff. So I'm listening to this music and I'm just really blown away by it. And what I began to feel was that something, there was something very special about this experience, right? Because of the way in which everybody talked about it. The theater was packed. There was not one empty seat, and it was a massive theater, like a, probably a 1,500-seater. And the screen is enormous. It was the biggest, I'm from Edmonton, Alberta, originally, and it's the birthplace of Marshall McLuhan, I might add. But so I watched the film, and I'm confused, mostly. But I liked it because it spoke to the part of me that I felt was an intellectual. Are you with me?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, everybody else who I wanted to come to see this movie didn't want to go with me. None of my friends. And I'm there with basically two strangers. And I'm watching this film and I thought, yes, that I'm going to see, I felt like I would see the movie better than anybody else in there. I really did. And I know.
That was the hubris with which I saw Eyes Wide Shut, was that no one would see it with me. And I was like, no, I'm going to go because I could figure it out. Yeah, I know. I sympathize immensely. Yeah.
Same thing with Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah.
Yeah. I felt the same way going into Eyes Wide Shut. And I was, what the fuck was that?
Yeah. I had to go back the next day. I was like, I guess I didn't get it.
I was really pissed off at Kubrick for that film. Really, really pissed off. I hated it. And I thought, what the hell is my fucking. This guy who I've like, I didn't even see a picture of him until I was like 37 years old. I had no idea what he looked like because this is all before the internet, right?
Right.
And finding books written about him wasn't easy. I'd only seen one photograph of him ever prior to my, to the internet, prior to 2001 when I actually got the internet for the first time. And that was from the scene of, it was taken on the set of Dr. Strangelove, and he's playing chess with George C. Scott. And the chessboard is sitting on a ladder. Of all freaking things, right?
I know.
And this guy is staging everything. And he can't be seen very clearly in the photo, but George Scott's sitting there looming over the board trying to figure out what his next move is going to be. So anyway, I'm in the, this is how I felt about this film. It was talking to me for the first time ever. I didn't even realize that I'd already seen a Stanley Kubrick movie before, The Shining, which I saw at the drive-in, believe it or not. So so I'm watching this film, and I thought, yes, this guy's talking to something inside me, basically. The film is saying to me, there's something important here that you need to pay attention to. So that's all I did. Something interesting happened halfway through the movie. Very fucking interesting. And, you know, this, it was when I discovered this, the meaning of this event, that I knew that I was definitely not the one in the film, who in the audience who was understanding the film. So what happened was, in the scene where Poole goes out the second time, Poole goes out. No, is it the first time? Yeah, Poole only goes out once. When he goes to replace the AE-35 and when he ends up getting killed by Hal. So somebody started barking like a dog for this. It's a lengthy scene, right?
Yeah.
And the theater is full and nobody is whispering. Nobody's talking, not a word. When this scene starts, this guy just starts to bark like, and he keeps it up. He keeps it up through the whole scene. And wow. Very near
serious coming through.
That's what I was thinking. That's exactly what I'm doing.
At very near the end of the scene, this is what the guy said, and I just could not fucking, when I found out what this meant, somebody yelled out, "Will someone put a muzzle on that guy?"
Oh.
Yeah, right. So muzzle, right? That's the Jewish term for a blessing, right? And it also adds up to 77, which is the same thing as Lieber Oz and all that other stuff.
Marvel.
So the whole Moon, Crowley, Parsons, it's all in there, right? So I kept watching the film, and I'm like, I was just trying to figure out what was going on. And I, of course, knew nothing about it, so I had no idea where it was going. And I during the Stargate sequence, I thought, I got to just put my head in this, but I wasn't able to do it. It was like I was banging my head against a wall almost. And at the end of the film, that was when it happened, right? That was when I had a kind of a moment where I'm like, oh my God, what the fuck? And I was frightened, is what I was. I felt very deeply disturbed. And the movie got out about 2:30. And, you know, this is the city of Edmonton, which at the time had only about 300,000 people in it. And there were no buses running at 2:30 in the morning. And I had to walk home. It was the middle of the winter. I was born in February. And I had to walk home for about 4 miles. And it was freezing, freezing cold. And this is what I'm doing. I'm trudging through dark, empty space. There's not one person anywhere around me. And I'm walking, interestingly enough, due north. But so that's basically the story. When I got home, my mom was sitting up. And she looked terrified. She was really mad at me. She was really, really mad because I hadn't told her I was going to do this, right? And she said, I've been worried about you. And I said, Mom, I just saw this film. And I mean, my hands were shaking, right? And she went, what's wrong with you? She actually thought I was on drugs. But I wasn't.
Right.
And her anger immediately went away when I started to talk about this. She started crying. She said, I don't understand. And I'm just babbling on about this movie, right? So I think that's a fairly interesting story. I went into as I continue along, what happened was the very next day I think it was a Thursday, I can't remember, but the next day I was supposed to go to school. I didn't go to school. I went to the library instead. I did this very often. I just haunt the library, the downtown library in Edmonton, and I wanted to find out what this movie meant. Like, I was on a mission, a serious mission, and I was not going to stop. I knew I couldn't. This is the thing. That's how much it haunted me. I didn't feel I had a choice in regards to whether or not I was going to figure out what this film meant. I had to know everything about it. I had to know the details so that there couldn't be any question in my mind that what I knew was correct. And I think this is also very much the concept of gnosis, to actually know, right? So I went to the library. I must have flipped through maybe 4 or 5 books. There wasn't very much in our library about it. There were a couple of them that here's a little interesting piece of trivia for you. You guys know the filmmaker Franco Zeffirelli, right?
I can't say I do.
You don't? He's most famous for bringing Shakespeare to the screen. He brought Romeo and Juliet to the screen. He did the Mel Gibson version of Hamlet, which is actually really, really good. And there's a film about his life called Tea with Mussolini, also, which is about his life with the Italian resistance. But anyway, so Franco Zeffirelli is this guy, this filmmaker. And after seeing 2001, and I read this the day after, or very close to the day after I saw the movie, this is he sent Kubrick a telegram, and this is what it read. You have made me dream, get ready for this, with eyes wide open.
Mm.
So that's how subtle Kubrick is. He named his last movie after a telegram from Franco Zeffirelli, right? The guy who apparently maybe didn't see what he was trying to say.
Hey, this is a total tangent. I apologize for this, but it's just I don't know where I'll ever get to drop this in. I could just message it to you, but whatever. I probably needs a quick context is. The Masonic Lodge, like 2 blocks from my house, had an open house, and I went to it just total out of curiosity. And it was obviously trying to be recruiting or public relations or whatever. And I didn't find their lecture particularly interesting, but I got to speak to – there was one old man there that I found very interesting, and I got to speak to him afterwards and trying to talk about some of the symbolism there. And – The younger guy who gave the presentation didn't really want to speak about it. He's like, well, even though it's all public, because I was like, well, I've read a lot of this stuff. I was like, I'm, you know, I don't want to be like that, but like, I'm pretty well versed. Like, I was like, I just wanted to have a conversation. What did he think? Blah, blah, blah. And he's like, well, I can't. He's like, even though it's public information, I took an oath not to talk about it, so I can't talk.
Right.
I'm like, okay, whatever. So the older man was not so withheld, and one of the things he said to me was, they had a representation of the third degree tracing board on the floor of the lodge, which was, they were saying it was very unusual that this lodge did this. They actually have in the marble mosaic inlaid into it this oak representation of the third degree board. And,
wow.
And he said, and the guy, and we're just looking at it, and we were talking about the 47th problem of Euclid and all this stuff. And he happens to mention, he goes, you notice on the board that the directions north, south, east, west, he says east, south, west are in white and north is dark. And he said the reason for that, he goes, because a lot of people think that it's, you know, something dark or satanic. He's like, but the real reason for it is because it's supposed to be a representation of Solomon's temple. And at that time, they considered that where the sun, it has to do with like astrology, where like where the sun would be at that time of the year and blah, blah, blah.
Yes,
and that there was no light in the north. And I just wanted to share that with you, Mark, because of your whole Eyes Wide Shut, San Remo, northern exposure, for lack of a better term. I wanted to share that with you.
Northerner, for sure. I spent a lot of time in the far north of Canada as well. But okay, that's very, very interesting. I'll continue my story then. So I started to research what the film meant, and I had no luck, basically. And it became essentially a lifetime obsession for me to try and understand what this film meant. And ultimately what that meant, and this is something that Bill talks a lot about too, when he's referring to Joyce and the idea of how when you look up from the book, you're no longer seeing the world, you're seeing the pages represented as the reality. That one thing impresses itself over the way you look at the world from that point on. So that's what happened to me with 2001, is everything I looked at, I didn't even realize it at first. I was looking at through an attempt to try and figure out this movie, essentially. And, of course, when I finally did, what would be called the worst, simultaneously the worst and best day of my life. I nearly died, essentially. This is the first time that I was watching the movie with the use of psychedelics as well. Anyway, that's basically my story, but you guys want to kind of pick this up where we should?
I want to drop something in here that has been on my mind, and first of all, it should be you mentioned 77, Oz. Somewhere in there. I heard it at some point. So I was mentioning that. And so it's interesting that also the same word for Oz, which is Joaquin and Boaz are the two. So established in strength. Oz is strength. Wizard of Oz, obviously. But the same word that's used to mean strength also means goat. And yes. And then 77 is the same value for the Greek for Pan. And so when you see the Pan Am ascending, after this whole, the ape throws the bone in the air, and then you see the satellite, that's the defense system, and then you see Pan Am ascending. There's this whole thing of the ascent of the mountain goat as the initiation, right? And so, and then that marks evolution, and that's the meaning of the Spag Zarathustra. He ascends the mountain, comes back down, and he's got the message, just like Moses, right? He's like, I've been to the top of the mountain. But what's crazy is the connection between the death of Martin Luther King and the release of 2001.
Mentioned this. Go on about this.
Which we should be aware of. Like, there's just this King connection. What's crazy also on a personal note is that in my mix, I have this whole speech from Martin Luther King in my mix while the evolution is taking place at the beginning, before I was ever aware of this MLK 2001 connection.
Interesting.
But then his whole thing is, I've been to the top of the mountain. And so, which means I've been initiated, right?
That's
and
great.
Then his death marking the release of the film. Very interesting. But then, okay, so there's this whole thing of, okay, so Kier, how do you say his name? Delea?
Yeah.
Delea?
Kier Delea.
Okay, so David Bowman in the film, he had played... There's a Hallmark Hall of Fame classic called Give Us Barabbas, which is obviously not a very big film, being a fucking Hallmark film. It's hard to find even, right? But so I'm just going to read I'm going to read something really quickly as possible from my blog, because it's the most direct way of putting it. So for someone unfamiliar with Barabbas's role in the New Testament, he is the other prisoner alongside Jesus, whom the crowd before Pontius Pilate voted to release instead of Jesus of Nazareth. The odd thing is that his first name is also Jesus, which means the anointed one, while at the same time Barabbas translates as son of the father. Now, Elisha, David Bowman plays Elisha in the New Testament, but Elisha in the Old Testament was a successor of Elijah, who receives So he receives Elijah's cloak. And so, and then remember the first film from 1914 of The Wizard of Oz, before The Wizard of Oz, everyone's familiar with, the MGM version was ever released, is called The Cloak of Oz, right? Which literally is the cloak of strength, which is the Elijah's cloak, okay? So when the prophet is taken up, so Elijah does the same thing that Enoch does, where he transcends, he gets taken up. This only happens twice in the Old Testament, once with Enoch and once with Elijah. So this is really interesting then that you have, like Jesus says, I and the Father are one, right? So right. Elijah's son is, who's likened to Jesus, Elijah's likened to Jesus, is so there's this whole thing going on. So he's taken up. Where this gets curious is when it is recognized that Elisha is arguably the closest depiction of Jesus of Nazareth in the Old Testament in terms of his miracle working and resurrection. So the man who played Barabbas himself in this film was James Daly, who is known as his part of Aronius in Planet of the Apes. Right. So the one who's reading from the Old Testament in Planet of the Apes, the ape version, who says ape God exactly. created ape in his own image, is right. incidentally fucking Barabbas, and give us Barabbas, who is Jesus. That so is. And then fantastic. And then 2001 is released within the same timing, for very close timing to Planet of the Apes 2001, very close together. So there's this whole thing. But then also, so he is almost in the same position as Pontius Pilate in terms of judging Charlton Heston, who is Moses. So yes. then David Bowie plays Pontius Pilate in The Last Temptation of Christ, while 2001's David Bowman is the New Testament Elijah in Give Us Barabbas. But obviously David Bowie did A Space Oddity, which was actually featured in a television coverage of the Apollo 11 mission, which is fucking weird, right?
It's obvious. Like that's what this is to me, and this is how I often feel about the films of Kubrick, is that they're remedial, right? Like they're very much like a slap upside the head from some kind of But there was something interesting that you said in there. God, see if I can remember. You know what? I can't right now, but.
It's not the Cloak of Oz, because that one's fucking tripping me out.
Crazy. That is very trippy. Well, actually,
have you seen that? The Magic Cloak of Oz?
I have not, no. But I'm going to look for it. I remember what it was I wanted to say. So this idea of Christ being Barabbas, right? That's essentially what you're saying.
What's that?
Is that Christ and Barabbas are one, right?
Well, that they're two sides of the same thing. So
I mean, a coin is a coin. Just because it has two sides, it's still one coin. So in this sense, this theory, and it's interestingly enough, because I think it was Aerosmith in his ThinkBook piece that used a quote from the movie Fallen with Denzel Washington. I don't know if you guys have seen this movie or not, but you should see it. You haven't? Have either of you seen it?
I have not.
Yes. And doesn't it have the Rolling Stones song that keeps repeating in it? Is that one?
Time is on your side.
Oh, okay. I have seen that. Okay, where he turns to a cat at the end or something?
Yes, for a moment. Yeah. So he can brush up against somebody's leg and become a human again.
Right.
Which also leads into the whole Egyptian thing. Like, that's what I think the cat thing at the end of the movie means. And also the cat from The Matrix. It's the exact same idea. So here... Here's how I interpret the movie Fallen, all right? From a Gnostic perspective, and this fits in exactly and as far as I'm concerned, it proves the concept. And because this is, to me, Gnosticism is strictly logical, obviously logic with a K. So here we go.
Logic with a K. I love that.
Yeah. So I'm not into magic. I'm into logic. Logic is everything to me. It defines the way I think, basically. So I'm thinking about this film Fallen, which is about this demon named Azazel, right? Which gives you Oz, maybe a little bit corrupted, but nevertheless, Azazel, whatever, is his name. And what he can do is he can enter someone's body, he makes them do terrible things, commit crimes, and then he leaves. And then they get punished for the crime, right? Well, it occurred to me that the promise of Christ upon his death on the cross, which, by the way, I consider to be accomplished, right? So the idea of the returning Christ is that's an issue that I don't want to get into. But this, if Christ is indeed the figure that we think he is, and we can go into the whole astrotheology argument because it's valid, but the whole point is it's just different names for the same character, right? So if Christ is indeed exactly what he claims to be, then he bears the weight of the sin of man upon him, right? He takes the punishment for our sins. You follow me?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, good. I when I hear the empty space, I wonder if you guys are drifting off into memory.
I think we're just allowing you to speak.
Oh no, I know that. This is just my anxiety, right? it's true. I'm a very anxious person. And I'm very nervous about talking to people too. So, but anyway, blah blah blah. So we'll throw in a little Slavo Žižek there. Blah blah blah. So So Christ bears the sin of man and takes the punishment. Well, it is a logical implication that the person who receives the punishment is the person who carried out the crime, right? Mm. So what this means is that when a human being commits a sin, it's not them, it's Christ. He actually enters your body, and this is why he's the ultimate glory hog, essentially. You know, Christ is the big glory pig of the universe. He wants the responsibility for everything, basically, whether it be good or bad. And so this is what he does is, because of his crucifixion, he is now able to enter into people and commit their sins and enjoy the pleasure of that sin too, which is an important part of the anomaly, and then take off before the punishment happens. So therefore, what happens to each human being is they end up walking the path of Christ, because they're always being punished for things that they actually are not responsible for. Are you following me there?
Sure, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, so this is the way, I think this fits in perfectly with your Barabbas analogy, basically, is that, you know, Barabbas is a barbarian, right? He also, in Kazantzakis' novel, Barabbas, he goes to the very pit of hell himself, Barabbas. He goes into these sulfur mines, where they work him like a slave, right, after he escapes his crucifixion. And he ends up getting crucified anyway. So Kazantzakis understood this too, that this is basically just Christ going through his motions, essentially. And so it all fits in with a very ordinary interpretation of Christianity, that Christ died for our sins.
It's also highly alchemical, the idea of going to a salt mine before your sacrifice. So working.
Yeah, it's actually a sulfur mine, right? Which fits in with the concept of Saturn as well, the Saturnine process and the sulfur bath used in the alchemical process, right? So there you have it. So yeah, I think that those two ideas fit perfectly together, quite frankly. Well,
there's something important here. So the name of the guy who plays Barabbas, who's also the ape of Heronius.
Yes.
Heronius is obviously a reference to the Western Roman emperor, right? Who ruled in Rome for a while, but the name is also attributed to one of the most influential texts of medieval magic. So the Sworn Book of Heronius is basically its main thesis point that it makes is that Jews should adopt he's basically that there needs to be something reconciled in terms of Christianity, that like if Jews were to adopt the meaning of the cross, not like, you know, he's presenting it as the gospel. But like my personal interpretation is that there's something very important about what, like, if you look at the Old Testament as an equation, that like you're basically, you're not necessarily solving the equation, but you're reconciling a major part of it when you reckon, like, if you look at the cube of space, like the meanings behind Rosicrucianism on an alchemical level, if you apply that to the Kabbalistic tree and all of the deep meanings of in the Zohar and the Old Testament. And so, like, I find it really interesting that he's saying if Jews would adopt the cross, everything would shift. And so there's this kind of like, and so you could look at it also that they were doing that in the first place when you consider what we found with the Sicarii and how they had this messianic movement that the Gospels kind of like were being given by the Roman emperors. Like, I mean, first recorded Christians were all of the Flavian court, right? They're not the people. That's not Judea's religion necessarily. But Judea's religion at that time very well may have utilized the cross as a solution to the Old Testament equation, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it does make sense. And just, I want to get back to 2001 here, but I want to add to what you just said about the idea of driving something. Like, this is...
This is 2001, because when they go through the Stargate, you have the cross.
Yes.
That's the whole point, is it's the cube of space unfolded, and that's what you go into the center of.
Correct. So it's being... So what's actually happened is that motion is being driven. Right, what's on the center is coming out to the outside. What's on the outside is moving to the inside, and it fits in with this idea that Jews adopt Christ. We can presume that I'm going to use the term Vallis loop, but that's actually not correct. I mean, Philip K. Dick was very wrong in a lot of ways, and I think that might have to do with the time in which he lived, you know, or it could have to do with the fact that he was sentimental, basically, about his own vision.
He's on the right track, for sure.
Yeah, well, definitely on the right track. Well, very much on the right track. But Vallis isn't actually a loop. It's a donut.
It's a torus, yeah.
Yeah, it's a torus, yes, exactly. So this is the way it works, is that we can already assume, according to the model that you just laid out there, David, about how Jews should accept the cross, that they actually already have. And they're being driven... in that direction to keep the motion of the exterior motion of the toroid going, right? So they actually do it, and then they unabandon it again later, and it takes you back again all the way back to the Egyptian age, which is kind of what's happening right now. I wanted to make a quick comment too about, because we were talking about earlier about the animal versus human nature, right? And one of the things that's extremely, for anybody, that there's a list of films I'm thinking of compiling, I probably should for researchers who are interested, that are extremely related to 2001. And obviously, pretty much it's already been busted now that that the Planet of the Apes, especially the original one, is modeled on the same storyline as 2001.
Oh, completely. But instead of space folding, it's time.
Yeah, that's exactly
No. Because this was my other realization. It's time. 2001 is about time.
Of course it is.
I don't know, that came out, but there's something to be said about the fact that when he realizes he's never left Earth, he's still within Malkut. The Statue of Liberty as Isis at the end mirrors the Star Child directly.
Absolutely. Yes, yes. Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Mother and child. But I guess one of my biggest realizations here is, okay, so as I'm watching the sequence, when I realize he's going to hell, right? This is before it gets particularly dark and paranoid and psychedelic. I realize he just said hell, and that Dave Bowman's entering hell. I think of the actual Odyssey, you know, Homer's Odyssey, and there's the idea that Odysseus at some point he doesn't actually descend into hell, but what he does is he opens a stargate. Ooh. It's really interesting because what he does is he draws a shape on the floor and pours some blood into it, and a doorway into hell opens up, and he's able to converse with the spirits of the dead, and they kind of want to come out, and like all these different things happen. And if you just read that book, I mean, it's very educational here, because you have things where he's basically conversing with the spirits of the dead. What he has to do is he has to like feed them some blood of the sacrifice. The fact that, you know, Frank Poole just died, all these things are just highly, highly significant. But the other thing, though, is that we have this one kind of Greco-Roman overlay, which is probably should be very obvious with the idea of it being called a space odyssey and all this sort of stuff, and him fighting the Cyclops and all these sorts of things. We've talked about the Kroilian aspect of no man in the actual Homer's Odyssey. When he fights the Cyclops, he takes on the name of no man. Crowley takes this as you can only unveil Isis. It's not that no one can unveil Isis, it's that you have to become no man. You have to become the egoless adept and all this sort of stuff. We can take this to the idea of Zarathustra. I don't know why I can't say that right now. The idea of Zoroaster, all these sorts of things of like basically the idea of dying, being reborn. I mean, this is all very, very obvious symbolism here. But what I'm coming to is the idea that, so in the book version of 2001, he's supposed to go to Saturn, right? And then Kubrick says he couldn't make it Saturn because of the special effects. He couldn't get the rings right. Mark, right, you've made the point that you said if he made it Saturn, it's too obvious. And the implication that I believe you're trying to say is the sort of satanic level of a Saturn significance. But taking it away from that for a moment, going to this idea of Saturn for the Greeks, you have this idea of he's not only the god of death, but also the god of time, right? So you literally have Saturn as Father Time, who yes. grows old and becomes the baby. He's Baby New Year, and Father Time is all in one, which is basically what Dave Bowman does when he becomes the Star Child. So, yes. but my other thing here is that, so not only does he go to the, like, what I saw in that experience was that Dave Bowman not only goes to the land of the dead, and I do very much believe he went to the land of the dead, right. But he's the Stargate sequence for me, as I was watching the colorful Stargate sequence, I was like, he's traversing time. He's no longer traversing space. He's traversing
yes,
time.
Yes, absolutely. You know, that you're dead right about that.
And just to say, so one of the immediate things I thought about was the idea of, for one, Back to the Future, as Jason Brera has pointed out many times, that when Marty travels back in time, he's actually aimed at the movie theater. So when lightning bolt strikes him, he's aimed at the movie theater. So this is both exiting Plato's cave, but also traveling through the movie screen Stargate is also a going back in time. And there's this idea, and in Donnie Darko, we talked about how Donnie Darko has a very similar thing where he opens a portal on the screen. And what is the screen? But they're showing a clock, so this is time, but it's also the movie that's playing is The Evil Dead. So you have the dead and time is a Saturnian Stargate. And then I just watched the other day a gentleman on Facebook recommended we look at the movie Flight of the Navigator, which I've actually never seen.
Yes, I've seen it.
Oh, really?
And,
Yeah.
I mean, astounded at how obviously they're referencing Sirius. Like, it seems... Oh, yeah. Blatant. Uh-huh. All the dogs. It takes place on 4th of July when Saturn and the Sun are in conjunction.
He transmits
the star maps into his head, blah, blah, all this stuff. And then there's it's heavy-handed Masonic imagery in the sense that, like, the spaceship opens up between two pillars and the staircase comes down, so you're climbing the stairway to Sirius. And on the fucking steps, on the steps the kid steps on, are giant letter G's. Like, I stop the movie and go to rewind it, and my wife just, like, kind of annoyed, goes, you don't need to rewind it. Yes, those were giant G's. Like, can we move on? Like, it was like...
Right.
Yeah, like, come on.
It's also a nut. He's also flying around in a nut, which is clefotic. He's in this clefotic nut, basically.
Yeah.
And, of course, the alien he meets inside looks very much like Hal. But so then I'm astounded at the movie ends with this kid going through a Stargate. So he's with Hal, and then he goes through a Stargate, and what is he doing but going back in time? And what I've come to see is that basically, when we talk about contacting the spirits of the dead, and going back in time would essentially be the same thing. To go back in time is to go back to a land or a time in which those that are dead, you're still able to communicate with them. So to
but
go...
the thing about that is that you're also one of them.
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
So in a sense, you are a zombie.
Yes.
When you travel through time, right? Yes. Because you've become the living dead.
So at the end of the film, when the Star Child is overlooking the Earth, is he overlooking the Dawn of Man? Is the whole thing of Alice Loop?
Well, okay, I'm glad you asked that, because I can give you what is my interpretation of the film, complete. And again, obviously there are many thin films in this cube. So I'm not trying to say that these other interpretations are not correct. I would never do that. As a matter of fact, when it comes to real serious Kubrick scholars, when it comes to anybody who looks at these films with real passion, essentially, I rarely disagree with anything they say. And it just all seems true to me. Because what's happening is the person is looking really hard, right? They're trying to see it the very best they can. So what they're reporting back is almost certainly going to be meaningful in some way or another. But the interpretation of what I'm offering now is absolute, all right? And I'm completely certain that this is what the movie 2001 is about.
All right, and, drop it.
Okay, we have to start at the middle of the story. That's where it really begins. And the middle of the story is HAL being invented. Okay, the computer HAL being invented. So what happens is that here's how it works. And this is a part this is all made quite clear in another film, which is essential viewing for people who love 2001. And it's called Colossus, the Forbin Project. So anyway.
I thought you were going to say Capricorn 1.
Capricorn 1's a good movie. Don't get me wrong. It's actually very good, but that's another story. No, that's one of the ones that's in the list of films that you need to see if you want to understand 2001 for sure. But this film, Colossus, the Forbin Project, it's a B movie. It's got very low production values. And it's about a supercomputer. And there's another film that also needs to be seen for 2001, also a B movie. And it's called The Demon Seed. It's also about a supercomputer. So let me explain what these movies, along with the information that we're talking about, provide an absolute interpretation of 2001. So what we have to do is we have to go to where HAL is invented, because it's very fair to say that HAL is the main character in the movie. The first, you know, people don't talk about Bowman or the Star Child almost with any kind of personality. The only character in the film that has any personality is HAL.
Yeah.
With the possible exception of the Moon Watcher. All right. And that's a very important point, because you mentioned how the eyes are red after the experience with the monolith. And I think that's really important. I'll get to what I think that means here.
It also makes him a stoned ape.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Right. The red eyes.
Yes, totally. And the whole connection between the 42 and marijuana because of 420, right?
Sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right. And the concept of Jupiter is all in there, too. So the idea of being stoned has so many meanings. The Stone Age, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everything is in there. Okay. And then the idea of the monolith as a stone as well. So what happens is we're now, you know, we're in Urbana, Illinois, and HAL is being programmed and made. Now, here's what. Why do human beings invent computers? The answer to that question is actually simple: to find out things that they couldn't find out without them, and to do things that they couldn't do without them. It's just that simple. We have invented computers, the human race, in order to help us fully realize ourselves as human beings, or at least what we think we should be as human beings. Okay, so that's fundamentally obvious. So what you have now is the computer being invented. And what happens is that once they start to realize that they've really designed a fantastic mainframe here, they start posing questions to HAL. But let me put this another way. What we have to understand is that when they're programming him, they're not just telling him, you know, how to run his logic. They're filling him with every bit of human information that is available from anywhere in the world. And I'm talking about throughout history. They've got thousands of people programming this thing, typing in every line of text that's ever been written, scanning them, putting every single bit of what is the human knowledge into this computer so that it can help them answer questions that they want to ask, basically. So, and ultimately the question is, how the fuck did we get here, right? But that actually turns out to be the answer to the movie, because the whole film is just a pun, right? On the term the Greek, well, I'll leave that for the end, because it's quite beautiful, really. The movie 2001 can be summed up in three words, a famous Greek expression, but I'll get to that in a second. So anyway, the computer's being programmed. You're getting my picture, right? It has every bit of human knowledge in it, and that's scientific, social, right, artistic. If you name it, it's in there. Biological, botanical, the whole fucking thing. So it's programming the computer, and when this is done, they then start to ask it questions, basically, that they have not been able to answer. And this is the so-called not enough data moment, right? Like, I don't have enough data yet. The computer in Hitchhiker's Guide from the Galaxy says, well, it'll take me a few thousand years to answer that question, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, but it's actually not true. that it takes Hal a few thousand years. As a matter of fact, at a certain point, he reaches critical mass, and he knows the answer to everything that they want to know before they're going to ask it, okay? And here's how he does it. In his mainframe, he has a visual, he has essentially what he can project as an interior or a mental hologram, where he can explore every aspect of what is known about humanity, every aspect. He can walk over every landscape, because obviously we're talking about a time when the whole Earth has been graphically detailed with space photography, basically. He can go be in any part of history that is part of the human memory and walk through these landscapes and see everything. In a sense, all of the movies made by Stanley Kubrick, and including Spartacus, are things that landscapes that Hal is walking through, all right? So anyway, what happens is this. He keeps walking, and everything seems to make sense. What the humans believe about their world is generally completely factual based upon his ability to look at it in a fully objective capacity, because as he moves through these worlds, he's not visible, right? He's almost like the camera, right? Just a camera somewhere. And you know, you pointed that movie, The Man with the Camera, out to me, Alan.
Yes.
And there's a line in the film where he talks about, or actually he was writing about it, I can't remember, but about how he can move his eye anywhere. Look at the shape of a horse galloping, and then go into a window where lovers are very quickly and without any, you know, without any impediment to his movement.
Yes, yes.
Basically,
yes.
So this is what Hal is doing. He's going through the mainframe of all knowledge held by humans, which we presume to be the most advanced species on Earth, and maybe in the universe, possibly. And that also turns out to be true. But so Hal's doing this. So he's going blah blah blah. He's looking around, and then finally he gets to the point where there's a question. He sees something that they haven't yet programmed. And it's the monolith. It's the first monolith. He's traveled far enough back in time with his knowledge of reality to get to a point where the question is finally posed. What is that thing? What is that fucking black thing sitting there? How the hell did it get there? Because it wasn't there last night, right? And so Hal's pondering this question, and then he instantaneously realizes what the monolith is, and that's the signal that is received by the apes, and then it passes on to the moon and then out into Jupiter. And this is what he realizes. I am the monolith. Reality exists inside Hal. He is seeing himself. The one question that the humans could not answer was the question about him. And they invented him to find him, essentially. So now what happens is we go out into space. And this is where Hal screams, all right? That's why they cover up their ears when the apes don't do that. And it seems to be the same kind of thing, right? A creature touching the surface of the monolith, having some kind of contact with it. But for some reason, this pisses the monolith off, and it causes physical pain to those there, as opposed to transforming them in some kind of positive way. And that's a really important part too, right? The early apes, the proto-humans, they don't have to ask anything. Their life is completely changed in an instant. But nothing has changed for the people who reach out and touch the monolith. They still don't know, right, on the moon. And this is because Hal is reacting to his own corruption, basically. That's what's happening. He's seen that that what was once a kind of a very passive, totally natural world has become encloaked, all right? Everything is now covered up. There are rules, there are laws, there are passages, there are doorways, there are gates, there's clothing, there are spacesuits. So the connection with the creature is no longer real, right? It's not there anymore. So when he reaches out to touch that monolith, it pisses Hal off because he wants to actually have contact, actual contact with the physical things in his universe, right? In this sense, he's God, all right? So, and of course, Al from the Hebrew God, right? And so anyway...
can I just interrupt you right there? It's interesting that you mentioned the Al as all and all that. And of course, all being the word pan meaning all, right? So going back to
course,
pan.
Yes, of course, yes, absolutely.
There is a point when Dave Bowman's outside and he's saying, Hal, is he saying hell?
Mm-hmm.
There's also a point at which it really sounds like he says, where he just leaves the H off. So it's like he says different things. At one point he says how. At one point he says hell. He actually says hell twice. But there's another time where he says al. And I think I specifically heard it. Again, when I was in the theater, I'm like, oh, it's like a selective hearing because my name is Alan. Not that anyone ever really calls me Al, but it's like, oh, I think I heard that because maybe it's what I wanted to hear. And then I realized later it's like probably because it's my name that, you know, you have like someone could be talking like in the next room and you don't really hear what they're saying. And then they say your name and your ears perk up. So it was kind of like that, like motherfucker just said my name. But I was like, so I'm thinking in the terms of Aleister Crowley, like, you know, and all this sort of stuff. But also... I like your idea of Al as all, or Allah and all this sort of stuff, but all being, again,
well,
being Al.
Yeah. I didn't realize for the longest time that Lieber Al was called, because I see two English letters. I don't think L. Like, it's supposed to be L. That's what it is. It's like, which is God, Elohim, the Elohim. Right. But then there's an interesting thing when he's saying, how do you read me, Hal? How do you read me? It flashes simultaneously IBM on his mask.
Absolutely.
To let you know, like, so as much as they want to deny it, when they actually, in the book, The Lost Worlds of 2001 by Arthur C. Clarke, where it's the behind the scenes stuff of 2001, he talks about the computer that was given to them by, I think it's a Macintosh, to look at the probability of those kind of things happening on their own. And it's like, it actually gives, it reads out a number of what the probability would be for them to have done that not intentionally. And it's crazy. So he's like, oh, well, that's just a coincidence. And Kubrick says that's a coincidence. That's not a fucking coincidence.
Of course.
Like, it would be, like, obviously. But even that aside,
well,
when you say...
When you see the IBM logo appearing as many times in that movie as it does, it's hard to think that's a coincidence. If it wasn't in there, if IBM was nowhere in the movie, you could say, "Oh, that's interesting. I didn't even think of it that way." But when you have IBM logos all over the fucking place,
yeah, and it was an IBM computer that sang fucking Daisy. That was a true story of IBM. So the first IBM computer fucking said, anyways, the other thing being that if you look at it that way, that simple procedure of moving one letter over, IBM is each one letter removed from H-A-L, then you have N-Y, New York, one letter removed from Oz, right? So there's this whole thing taking place with like the end of Planet of the Apes where he's in New York, sees the Statue of Liberty, goes down to his knees, and he's like, you maniacs, you blew it up, you split the Adam, split the atom, right? Like, there's definitely something going on there. The same.
Well, I have some ideas about it. Go ahead, Ellen. Sorry.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. And the Big Apple. It's a fucking wormhole in the Big Apple. Like,
that basically
being the fucking Apple computer. I don't know. I'm just. Just
no, no, no! You're on the money, as far as I'm concerned. Absolutely on the money. But so let me. Okay, I can't. There was something that you were saying, Alan. I wanted to comment on.
I don't know. I just said that the IBM logo appears so many times. It's hard to think.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, no. I'll just forget.
I don't know
about
if I maybe I said something else. I don't remember.
I'll move on with my.
I've had as always happens with us. It's like I have like 37 thoughts, and then I.
Yeah. Right. Okay, no, I remember what I wanted to tell you, because you're talking, and David, it was actually you that made me think of this, the whole HAL plus, or one letter away from IBM, right? Well, let me just run this down quickly for you, because I think it's an interesting, I might have told you this already, but, you know, sometimes these things have to be repeated. That's why we watch these movies over and over again, too, I guess. But anyway, so, you know that if you've followed everything online that there is about Kubrick, you might have heard an interview with Brian Aldiss. And it's in the now very difficult to see Stanley Kubrick's boxes, which has been, I think, deliberately pulled because it gave away way too many clues.
Right.
But that's what I think. But anyway, so in Aldiss is talking about, because Aldiss is the guy who wrote Super Toys Last Longer, which is what they were going to base AI on, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Aldiss was working on the original screenplay for AI, like way back in the late 70s, right? With Kubrick lording over him, right? He would actually go into Kubrick's estate and work there, and Kubrick would constantly be pestering him. And the main thing that Aldiss remembered was that Kubrick was obsessed with the idea of Pinocchio, right? Obsessed with it. But all this pronounces Pinocchio in the correct way, which is Pinocchio, okay? Which is, that's how you'd say it in Italian, Pinocchio. Well, you guys are familiar with the idea of spoonerisms, right? Like, you know, where you...
Are you sort of saying like would... Enoch? Like the Pinocchian magic?
Yeah, absolutely. Sure, I didn't think of that, but okay, so we know that Kubrick is obsessed with Pinocchio, and it's in regard to his ideas about AI, all right? Well, let's take HAL. The Hebrew summation of HAL, as I'm sure David knows, is 36. So, and then you have the addition of IBM, which makes 52, all right? And I'm not including finals in this, obviously. So, so we have 36 and 52. Now, the sum total of those makes 88, all right? Which is interesting, okay? Yeah. But which is interesting in a whole bunch of different ways, but it's most interesting in terms of the fact that there are 88 keys on a standard piano. And there have been basically forever, right? So you have 88 keys on the piano. It's very interesting that the very bottom key is an A, and it's on a white key. And then the very central key is a C. That's also on a white key. The top note, the highest pitch, is also a C. So that gives you Arthur C. Clarke on white keys. Now there's the reason that's important is because Kubrick's initials, or Kubrick's, the letters in his name, form a perfect anagram of I turn black keys, right? So here we have the idea of black keys and white keys equaling the same amount as HAL and IBM, okay? But here's the kicker, and this is the beautiful thing, is that if you make a spoonerism, if you mix up the syllables in the term Pinocchio, you get piano key. Okay, so I think that's quite fascinating in terms of just the level of encoding that's going on in here. But let me continue now. If you guys, unless you guys want to throw something in.
Well, just to say, 88 is been connected to Mercury. As well as Sirius, but you have the idea of Mercury
and Hitler. Don't forget Hitler.
Oh, well, sure, yeah.
That's very important in terms of the fact that that IBM supposedly helped tally up the.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, so yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
Absolutely, IBM. We should not.
The guy who broke that story's name is Edwin Black, by the way.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, you know, I hadn't thought of the IBM Holocaust connection. In relation to 2001, but that's actually fascinating.
Oh yeah, the cryogenic freezing, and then you can tie that into Planet of the Apes too, really, really well. Yeah, it's fucked up.
Yep.
Huh. Yeah. But then that, particularly with that German flag, yes. And the IBM, well, really.
The whole idea of Kubrick. Kubrick's films tell the truth. His mouth lies. All right, that's right. The way it is. If it came out of his mouth, it's a lie. If it's in his movies, it's the absolute truth. So what does that mean? It means he's a maze master. That's what it means. He has made a maze for that people can and do enter, basically. And he actually implies that that maze is on a universal scale. But anyway, let me just continue with my, if you don't mind, with my complete analysis.
Oh, please. Yeah.
So what we have now is we have Hal reaching this moment of critical mass when he looks back in time and he sees the one thing humans don't know about himself, basically, and he recognizes that he's some kind of touchstone, but he's not really sure what it is, right? And he reaches out, he communes with these creatures, and they are endowed with his sense of intelligence, but they don't have his sense of logic, right? They don't have a computer in their brain. So they might fumble a lot, but they have his sense of intelligence, right? Different than logic. Okay, so... And by the way, one of the things that Arthur C. Clarke put in his novelization of 2001 was that when the apes touched the monolith, that it shimmered like a pool of water, basically.
Right, I remember that. Water, and then the stars emerged from it, right?
Yeah, so, right. So that, this
or
is the
not just the stars, but the whole, yeah.
And it's very narcissistic, too, right? Because it's the idea of the thing looking at itself, seeing itself for the first time, and in a sense falling in love with the concept of itself.
Oh, right. And don't forget that the narcissist flower is the Star of David. And then you have Bowman.
Beautiful.
Oh, well, yeah, can I just say, this is it. I'm sorry, Mario, I don't want to keep interrupting
you. No, don't be sorry.
But that's highly profound for me, because what I, after leaving the movie, as I dove into this nightmarish, with intermittently not nightmarish, but fairly nightmarish Gnostic experience after leaving the theater, one of the things that was so dominated by, and again, I don't know if this was flavored by my sort of initial request for the night of wanting to see it through your eyes, Mark, but I had this experience where I basically experienced your Moon in the Middle sync book chapter.
Yes, and, well, that would be, that's because that those lessons are in Kubrick.
Right, right, right.
That's,
so
that's, all Kubrick's movies are about one thing only, the moon. That's it. All of them are about the moon, and it's you can see it.
Well, yeah, my thing, I don't mean in a lunar sense. I mean in the idea of like Sophia and Christ separating to see, and it's,
yes,
like how,
yes,
do you, if you become one, then you're lonely to separate, and the sort of all this sort,
yes,
of stuff. And because my wife's sober, I'm basically out of my mind. I will admit, you know, I don't know if we're airing this or not, but
I hope so.
Oh yeah, okay. If you're cool with it, and I'm just gonna say it. This is brutal honesty here. I've talked many times about synchronicity, a study of synchronicity being a sort of controlled schizophrenia. I had a terrifying period of really uncontrolled schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm. Welcome to my world.
Yeah.
I live like that 24 hours a day.
And
you think you're on drugs, buddy. You should try my drugs. Topical, Seroquel.
You are both on something and onto something at
exactly.
the same time.
Yeah.
But I have this image of Charlton Heston on Planet of the Apes planting fucking American flag in the soil, but he's actually on Earth and he's never left. And like 2001 being that you feel that you've left the theater, but you've never left or something.
Right. Yes.
I don't know. Like,
yeah. Okay. Perfect. Because what I mean, basically the experience, you know, I don't, especially I don't want to interrupt your story more, but just to say like, what I mean is, and not in a lunar sense, but in the idea of like to see oneself is a concept is it requires a sort of separation and step back to look at yourself, but in doing so you have to fragment yourself. It was just this really I don't know if I can even do the experience justice, but there was a point where like my wife tried talking to me, and it was like if I held her or if she held me, then I was like, okay, I was in this completely merged, but like she was gone. Like,
right.
It's like, okay, all right, I'm one. You know, I'm like one with the all or pan or whatever. It's like, but where did everyone go? Oh,
right,
fuck.
Right.
Okay, so now I have to leave. If I want to actually engage the experience, I have to separate from the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely.
All these sort of things that you could kind of stumble out of that, and I think actually ties into your idea of why Hal might scream, if you're equating Hal as the monolith, why,
yes,
when the spacemen touch the monolith on the moon, that they're doing so through a protective layer, that they're,
yes,
actually not able to connect and merge anymore.
That's right. They're not touching. Yeah, exactly. So, but okay, so let me continue then. So when this happens and the signal sent out to Jupiter, right? So, and this, by the way, I just want to touch quickly on the whole Freudian thing too. Like, I know you guys are both basically Jungians, and that's, I would say that I am not. I'm definitely a Freudian and a Lacanian as well. So, and that all had, the basic idea is that there's a strictly logical structure to reality, and that, it's funny because it actually fits in with Kabbalah and other types of mysticism, but I don't actually consider Kabbalah mysticism. I consider it science. So that's just, you know, and I think that Jung, just as Freud thought, is kind of off track. But nevertheless, I just wanted to point that out because
whatever, Freud took most of his things from mysticism and then would never admit it, unlike Jung.
Oh, I know he did. Absolutely.
Right.
I'm not praising Freud the human being. I'm praising the work. The work that he did, I think, is the most profound work of the 20th century in regards to the analysis of the psyche, which is what we're all here for, apparently, because it's a fucking madhouse and we're all getting therapy constantly.